You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Jay Cutler. Started a new podcast called Uncut with Jay Cutler. Most of you know me from the NFL. Some of you have seen me on Instagram. And some of you know me from the reality TV world. Each week I'm taking you along with me as we discuss football, trending topics, and whatever's going on in my life each week. I'm bringing along people that are special in my life. Former teammates, friends, and some new people that I like and respect. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Podcasting? I think I'm doing this right. Can't wait to get started with you. Go subscribe now. Uncut with Jay Cutler. Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify. Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is the great Sam Vecenie of The Athletic, and the primary crux of our conversation is the introduction, as I think of it, for me, to the 2022 NBA draft class. Of course, we don't know exactly who's going to be in it, but the top guys on Sam's board, who to watch going into the season. And then we also transition into the just drafted 2021 class, the rookies in now, who he's excited to see, who has a real chance to break out this year. Great conversation, runs a little bit over an hour. Hope you really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Danny, this is the first time that we've been on this podcast since you've been married. I could not be happier for you, and I could not be happier to be here. Does it feel different for you to have guests on the podcast now that you are married?
Not particularly, but it is different now that the season's getting going. And, you know, the part of the adjustment for me was I got back from my honeymoon less than a week before the start of the regular season, or basically a week from the start of the regular season, and it's like, oh, I'm running now. Like, this is, you know, you all the stuff that happens when you're planning a wedding and executing a wedding and a honeymoon and all that. And then you're like, you're trying to do the, like, calm down. It's like, nope, just kick back in. But that's honestly how I run. So I think it's not that bad. It's just different.
Yeah, it's true. No, you're in a great space now. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. We're recording before you're about to get started with Nate on a NBA cast, which is fantastic. Like, we're in a good space here. I love it. I'm excited.
We are. And I want to start this, and it'll be interesting to see if you agree with me. So it's just a weird thing that I noticed over the last few weeks. I know about as much about the upcoming NFL draft as I do the NBA draft, which is to say not very much, because it's been a couple of years since I've been able to scout guys in person and everything else like that. But there's an interesting parallel that I've noticed just in my casual looking, and I want to run it by you. So I'm, you know, our mutual colleague Tim Kawakami of The Athletic mentioned that it's like there are a lot of teams that need quarterbacks, and this is a weird draft year because there aren't that many quarterbacks. And I don't think there are as many NBA teams that need point guards, primary ball handlers as that, because there are a lot of good ones already in the league. But it seems to me, looking through your board, looking through a few other ones that are out there, that preliminarily, this doesn't look like the draft for you if what you're looking for is somebody to run your offense.
No, I straight up do not think that it is. Most of the good players in this class are big players. They're 6'11", 6'10", 7 foot tall. Some of them have a chance to be shot creators. Some of them don't really. There are a couple of guys that, like, I'm somewhat interested in because they're good perimeter players that are, like, strong high level scorers. But I don't know, man. Like, I wouldn't feel comfortable with, like, you know, Jaden Hardy straight up running your offense. And then you get beneath that class, you get like Jaden Hardy and Jaden Ivey. I mean, like Ty Washington's like not crazy athletic and might not be able to run an offense. He might be more of like an off guard. You know, like Bryce McGowan's has some like combo ability, but again, not a guy that's going to run your offense. The top rated like true lead guard that I've heard, that I have ranked right now is Kennedy Chandler out of Tennessee. And I'll be honest, like I've heard pretty mixed things about him from scouts that have gone down to Tennessee and seen them play. Like I've heard better stuff about Justin Powell, who's like a 6'5" like combo floor spacer, you know, I guess like shot creating, you know, combo guard is the best way to put it, who was at Auburn last year, than I have about Kennedy Chandler. So it's weird. It's a little bit weird trying to navigate where the lead guards are right now in this class, for sure. I think that specific statement from Tim is right, because I do know quite a bit about the NFL draft as well. I keep my eyes on that. Mostly for like the crazy fucking dynasty fantasy football league that I'm in with my college friends and shit. Like right now, from what I like gather, it's like Malik Willis, and Malik Willis probably shouldn't even be a top 10 pick, but he'll probably end up going there because there's just a total dearth of total dearth of quarterbacks.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, and you wouldn't expect those things to run in parallel, especially when you consider, I mean, if this matters or not, that there's the age difference between when players go into the NFL and go into the NBA. It happens, and it's you're always tied to the supply that is available. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there should be a distinction between not having those specific players and not having good players. Like, I think this draft has a lot of intriguing talents, and there will always be players that blossom, particularly when you think about the precursor for a lot of these guys. If you're a college freshman, think about what your life has been the last couple of years and your potential exposure. I mean, I think maybe the best example of that, of the guys that I'm at least a little familiar with, is AJ Griffin, where it's just like he hasn't played much. And so that is,
and he's hurt now, by the way.
Oh jeez.
Yeah, he has a injured knee at the moment. Geez. So he's gonna miss a month, maybe ready for the start of the season, probably not though, it seems like.
That's incredible.
Yeah, he hasn't played in like all but one competitive setting in 18 months. Like, it's crazy.
But so just to kind of fact check it, how do you feel preliminarily? I mean, we're still, you know, these guys, as a lot of these guys, haven't played a college/G League Ignite or whatever game yet so far. How do you feel about this class just preliminarily versus the last couple? Do you like it? Do you think it's okay? Do you think it's weak?
I like it much less than the 2021 draft class, which I thought actually had some like pretty interesting depth, and I obviously loved the top of that class. The 2021 draft class, I think, has legitimately four all-stars that are awesome. And then I liked Scotty Barnes and Jonathan Kuminga. Like, Jonathan Kuminga would absolutely be a top. I wouldn't have him ahead of Paulo and Chet, but I'd probably have him three right now among prospects in this class. So, and frankly, like, once we start considering positional value, it would depend on how Paulo and Chet look this year, given that Chet is 7'1" and extremely skinny, and given that Paulo is really creative but has some athleticism concerns. So I'm not wildly enthused by this class at the moment. I also think that last year there was some real depth in the class. I felt like you get good players into the 40s, and I think the players will absolutely emerge and will become, over the course of the year, players worth drafting in the 40s that like I will end up with first round grades on the teams just like aren't quite as high on. This year, like, I'll be honest with you, like, right now, I've probably got 14 first round grades that like I feel good about, that I'm like, okay, I think this player is definitely going to go in the first round.
And that's less than you usually have at this point in the year, because I know a lot of times you just need to watch more and there are guys that you like.
Yeah, like, sometimes I'm wrong on guys. Like BJ Boston last year, like, I definitely had a first round grade on him going into the year, and I was just wrong, right? Like, he was not that guy. And you move off of that, you always make adjustments. And I tend to be a little bit more aggressive with adjustments than other people are. But take someone like Bryce McGowan's this year. Bryce McGowan's is like 6'7". He has a 6'10 wingspan. He's more combo guard than wing, but has like real ball handling abilities. He's super tough. He's very aggressive. Loves to play through contact. He's also 175 pounds right now and is a questionable shooter at the moment. If he has his feet set, he's really good. If he is trying to get to a step back on a pull up, he has kind of an unnatural lean to his left with his jumper. Like, he could fly up the board and be a top 12 pick. He could like shoot 37% from the field this year and 32% from three and end up having to return for a second season. Like, I think that there are a lot more questions like Bryce McGowan's out there, who has a lot of talent and who I think will be an NBA player at some point, but it might not be this year. And what do you do if it's not this year?
Yeah, that's a great point. So let's get into the top of the class, though. I know that there has already been some chattering about Paolo Banchero and Chet Holmgren and possibly Jalen Duren getting into that group with his crazy measurables at the Memphis Pro Day. How would you let's start with the guy that you have number one, Paolo. How do you see his strengths and weaknesses both this year and more kind of, for me, more importantly, going into the NBA?
Yeah, so Paolo Banchero is one of my favorite prospects I've ever evaluated. Like, you know how sometimes you just have favorites? You know that they're not the best.
Yeah, so this is sort of like your favorite TV show versus the best TV show.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I love the movie. Like, I love Undercover Brother, right? Like, I think that movie is absolutely hilarious. It's one of my favorite comedies from the 2000s. I know it's not like the best movie in the world, right? It's just funny and I love it. Paolo's like a higher level player than that. Paolo is a genuine like top, you know, he's, we'd probably go like 4 or 5 in most drafts, I think. But again, like, I have him at number one right now because I think that there are just more questions about the other players. But the reason that I say he's one of my favorite players I've ever evaluated, I've seen him a lot, like from the time that he was in 10th grade. And he had more like defensive rotational awareness and consistency than like any high-end five-star prospect 10th grader than like I feel like I'd ever seen. Really high level passer, really high level understanding of how to play the game in a way that leads to wins. And then over the course of his collegiate or high school career, he started to develop into a legit perimeter big who also can handle the ball and can create his own shot. Now, he's still like a bit of a questionable shooter in my mind. Like, I don't know if he's going to shoot 35% from three this year quite yet. I think he like could, and I think he could get up to like 36-37, but I don't know that for a fact yet. I want to see where it settles in. But I'll tell you this, like, he can grab and go on the break and lead the break, and then he can do like a quick inside out dribble into a crossover into like a sidestep to his left, step back three pointer. And I feel like okay about it, especially for a 6'10" kid that's 18 years old, right? I'm a big fan. The question is, he's not a super athlete. He's not like crazy explosive. He's 6'10", so he's kind of in that middle ground between being like a true 4 and a true 5. He doesn't have like crazy length or anything. He's almost certainly going to have to play the 4 in the same way that like Julius Randle like has to play the 4 to have successful defenses out there. But I love his offensive playmaking, and I think that Banchero is starting from a level of such high level like rotational awareness defensively that I just think that he'll make it work at the next level defensively. And then you add the offensive skill. He's going to be a real mismatch problem for any team he plays in college basketball this year.
Well, something you brought up with Banchero in your profile, in the write-up that you did of him, that I always love, and I mean, you and I have talked about this a lot over the years, is players who are aggressive and skilled attacking mismatches. It's part of what makes Jokic so great, part of what made him the deserving regular season MVP last year, is that a lot of times now you think about the way that the different coverages that teams can use, and that if you're using Banchero as a screener, then if the other team wants to switch, then they're oftentimes you're conceding you're conceding a matchup to one or both players involved in the action in order to avoid the seam, the scrambling back and everything. Incidentally, Jokic is a good example of that too, defensively. And so one of the best ways to attack that system is actually, one of them is having a point guard who can just drill that shot or who can attack, do the dribbles. You can think of Dame Lillard or Steph Curry or any number of other guys there using the small who can do it or can drive by or whatever. The other way to do it, bringing up Jokic again, is by having the screener be able to take advantage of that, and so that you're hesitant to switch. And if Banchero can do that, it creates different opportunities, honestly, if he's a 4 instead of a 5, just because, we've seen the Hawks and a few other teams do plenty of screening action with the 4, but it's still something that you can use really well.
Yeah, no, I agree with that totally. I'll be interested to see if Duke actually does that. Like, I just don't know that they will at the end of the day, because that's like not been a consistent part of their offense over the course of their just like run under Coach K. And that's not like a shot at Coach K. It's just not really what they do. Like you saw last year, like Jalen Johnson, I don't want to say he did struggle. I don't know that it was because of Duke's offensive fit. I think it was more Jalen related issues, but I think that there's probably some room. He's going to be playing next to a really great big man who I also have as a first round pick in Mark Williams. Mark Williams is just like enormous inside and takes up space. I'll be very interested to see what Paulo looks like as a finisher this year, given that he will often be playing with someone that's going to take up as much space inside as he's going to.
The other player who has been most frequently discussed as a viable number one pick is Chet Holmgren. Holmgren has been on the draft radar for a long time. He is somebody that I've seen. I saw him in Colorado Springs years ago. I believe he was a junior, high school junior at the time, going to Gonzaga. And Holmgren, you could make an argument, I think I would, that he is hurt by the kind of the evolution of the NBA, because like if you went back 20 years, 30 years, like a player who's 7'1", who has some of the defensive tools that he does, even though he's skinny as all get out, would be there. But there is that question of, I don't know, do you agree with me, or do you think that because of the skill development that Chet has, that he benefits from the modernness?
He definitely benefits from the modern NBA. He also is, look, like, I just don't know what Chet's going to look like at the college level in terms of defense, because I will tell you this, like, I don't know that I've seen, certainly among these, these very skinny prospects, these skinny bigs, I've definitely never seen someone who is as competitive as he is. Like, he wants to block every shot. He contests every single shot when he's inside. Like, there, he is totally fearless. He is unafraid of getting dunked on in a real way. He initiates contact inside. It sounds weird for someone who's 7'1", 190 pounds, but like, he's very comfortable initiating contact. It doesn't always work. He doesn't always have the best contact balance, but he's comfortable doing it, which I think is a really good sign if he can continue to put on weight long term. I'm pretty worried about the frame, to be honest, but he's so skilled as an offensive player. Like, he can handle the ball out on the perimeter. I think Paulo's a little bit better as like a half court ball handler, creating his own shot. But in terms of like being able to grab and go, and like, Chet can do more creative things off the bounce, whereas like Paulo's is a little bit more functional. I think that he has so much skill level development. Plus, he's 7'1" with ridiculous length, as opposed to Paulo, who's like your run of the mill 6'10" guy with like a 7'1" wingspan. Like, I think that he's skilled enough to make it work. I think he's definitely going to shoot it. If not like from a 37% level this year, he'll get there at some point. I love how tough he is. I love the rim protection potential he has. I just worry that I worry about the frame substantially. Look, if he was entering like the 1990s era of the NBA, I think he'd really struggle just given the physicality.
But yeah, given how big everyone was. That's a, like, thickness wise.
Yeah, like I think that he's definitely better suited, to answer your question. Like, I think he's definitely better suited for now. But in terms of mentality, like, he would be suited to play in that era. It's just whether or not his body long term is going to let him play the way he wants to play, because I have just an immense amount of respect for the way that he wants to play every single night. Like, I'm a big fan. I think he certainly has the most upside of any player in this class. It's just whether or not his frame lets him hit that upside.
Yeah, I've been looking through the kind of the draft measurement histories to try to find somebody who's kind of comparable, and the only one that I'm seeing just over the last few years is actually Moses Brown in terms of just height and wingspan, you know, roughly 7'1", roughly 7'5" wingspan, which is what I'm seeing for Holmgren. Moses Brown, not the biggest guy in the world, is 237. Holmgren is under 200, right?
Yeah, like the comp that a lot of people have made is Kristaps. Kristaps was very skinny when he was 19, because if you remember, he entered the NBA when he was 21. So he had like an extra year and a half of like physical development. And I've talked to, like, Larry Sanders was with him, who used to work for the Bucks and was training him over, I believe, if I remember correctly, he's with Sevilla pre-draft. And he like really went through and like worked with Kristaps to like gradually put on weight to where he is at least strong enough now. Like, he's 240 pounds now, which is still like 50 pounds more than Jet, but he's 2 inches taller. And I think that that's the hope, that like he can gradually put on weight in the way that Kristaps did to at least develop some core strength. He's always going to be at like something of a disadvantage just due to the fact that his frame is what it is, right? But can he overcome that disadvantage through skill and through just sheer aggressiveness? Like, I kind of think he has a shot to, but it's not going to be the easiest road for Chet Holmgren. But if it works, it's like really going to work at an exceedingly high level, I think.
Yeah, and part of what makes Holmgren so intriguing as an NBA player is that I brought this up with Banchero before, is that I think offensively, from what I've seen, he fits pretty seamlessly in the high pick and roll concepts. You know, like he's not the greatest screener because he's not as thick as you'd like. But in terms of having the game, if you're, you know, I was thinking about the Warriors-Lakers game, which occurred on Tuesday night, and how if you're doubling or doing anything like that to the small, then you want a big who can do something with the ball in their hands, whether that's make the jump shot or make a good decision or create a take advantage of that mismatch and create a new one, ideally. And Holmgren has the building blocks to do that pretty well. And that's not the same as using him as the hub. Like, I brought up Jokic a couple of times during this, and, you know, Jokic and Towns and Embiid kind of have that kind of potential. And I haven't, in the limited amount of time I've seen Holmgren, I haven't seen that potential from him. But being able to do something, like, it's the criticism I've levied on Clint Capella a lot over the years. It's like, being able to do something positive when the ball is in your hands and there's already an advantage is so important in the NBA right now. And I think it's only going to become more important over the next 10 years.
I will say, we're apparently going to get some Obi Toppin at center tonight.
Interesting.
Excited about, because that is what he should be playing. He should be playing center. And that kind of goes toward what you're saying, like having a center or a big with some ball skills. I think it's such a bailout for offenses in today's NBA. Like, it's still a real marginal efficiency to be able to have those guys that, you know, can shoot, can handle the ball, like a John Collins, right? Like, that's why Atlanta's offense probably works a little bit better when John Collins is the five. Obviously, like, John Collins has gotten better defensively, but he's gotten better because he's a lot more rotationally aware and is a lot more mobile now, and more comfortable defending on the perimeter and getting bend in his ability to slide than what he was, you know, necessarily early in his career. But, man, I mean, like, being able to have some skill, some bailout ability, like Capella, you mentioned, he got, like, he got passable at it in Houston. Like, he got, like, okay at being able to hit that, like, cross-corner kick. Like, that was – when he was in Houston, that cross-corner kick from the short roll – in their offense was there every single play to either PJ Tucker or to it was like House a little bit late in his tenure, but that pass was always there. And it took him, I don't know how many years, 3 years to really like get to the point where he could make that pass consistently. Being able to make that pass, like I think is so critical. Just being able to make the pass that is available to your offense. Like we saw last night, and people will figure out what day we recorded this based off the way I'm speaking, I realize. We saw last night with Nemanja Bjelica entering the Warriors scheme, right? We saw the value that having someone who can make high-level passing reads from the center position be that outlet for when teams blitz Stephen Curry. Teams typically don't blitz Stephen Curry when it's Draymond Green, but they have for so many years been able to do that when anyone else sets a screen.
Yeah, like Kevon Looney or Wiseman last year.
Right. With Bjelica, I don't really think you can do that if they play him as regularly as I think they might end up playing him. So I'm intrigued. I'm very intrigued with what we saw from the Warriors last night, and it all goes toward what your point was, which I think was really smart.
While we're thinking about the evolving nature of the center position, I mean, not all these guys are centers, but it's always been a hallmark for our conversations on this with Banchero, Holmgren, Jalen Duren. Any of them you think viable as a switch defender?
Chet moves his feet well, but has a bit of a high center of gravity, which I worry like smaller guards and wings might be able to leverage a little bit. Jalen Duren is interesting. He's like, look, the comp for Duren is like Bam Adebayo, but I don't think he is as twitchy as Bam is. Like, he's a bit heavier footed, and I kind of think that because he's 6'11, maybe 6'10 and a half, let's say, with a 7'5 wingspan, he might just be better off playing a drop, like where you can get the full extent of his rim protection. He is a very good rim protector. He has really earned and developed the motor that comes with having to play the center position. Like, it took him a little bit of time early in his career. He'd turn it off and on for sure. I think that over the course of the last couple years of his career, he's really kind of navigated that and made it to the point where he is much better at consistently playing hard. I think that like there's a world where he could switch. I don't know if I feel great about him switching, if that makes sense.
It does. And Duren got, to me, like in terms of, you know, again, much more casual, especially in this stage on it, he got a lot more attention after Memphis's pro day because it was this, you know, when teams actually do this, and full credit to Penny for putting this on, that they do real measurements and all that. And everybody was excited to see this as an extremely talented group of players. And Amani Bates, his measurements did not exactly line up with what people were hoping for, though I'm sure it wasn't as big a surprise to you. But then Duren just being like, oh crap, this guy has like a big wingspan, this guy has the, you know, like kind of has the physical tools, it became a lot more viable for him to potentially be a five.
Yeah, obviously, look, neither of those measurements came as a surprise to me. I think I had Jalen Duren listed like 6'10 with a 7'4 wingspan. He came in 6'11, 7'5 wingspan. I've had Imani Bates at the 2019 Nike Basketball Academy came in at 6'7 with a 6'7 wingspan. That's why the Kevin Durant comparisons have always been like just totally foolhardy. I know that he came, I think that like he was 6'9 in their in the Memphis measurements. I think that those Memphis measurements were with shoes. And I think the Nike Basketball Academy measurements were without shoes. So I do believe that they are consistent measurements. I'm a little bit worried about Imani long term, but I've been worried about Imani long term for a while now, and I've made those points clear, and I hope that he is able to navigate what is going to be like an interesting, potentially difficult start to his career. We'll see.
So I know after, and I encourage everybody to read the mock draft and the write-ups that you've done for The Athletic, you feel a lot more, a lot less confident after this top three. And I mean, even we've talked about the limitations of this group. I'm not going to ask you kind of who you like best because people can read that in there. But taking that aside, if we made the only criteria, which other prospect is most likely to have the type of season that puts them firmly in the mix to be the number one pick? So basically kind of like who has the highest immediate ceiling of everyone else?
Look, I it's hard. Like, am I judging against like this class or like a normal class? Like, I think I would say that if AJ Griffin is healthy and if he is what he was at the U16 FIBA Americas tournament that occurred in 2019, if my memory serves, he has like real upside. He is 6'6", he's 7 foot wingspan, he has a chiseled frame that will have no problem translating to the NBA. He is a real conscientious defender. He has some real shot creation abilities, has showcased some passing in the past. Like he has all of the tools, but it feels ridiculous to bring up AJ Griffin within this conversation because like he's barely been seen in 18 months. Like he might end up being like the 30th overall pick. He might end up being the number one overall pick. I've heard really good things about Jabari Smith out of Auburn. 6'10", spacing four, can create his own shot a little bit, but not quite as well as someone like Paulo in the tape that I've seen. Much more switchable onto perimeter wings, good weak side rim protector. I think there is a world where he will shoot. Like I have no doubts that he'll shoot it long term at that size. I think there's a world where he could go number one overall as well. But this is kind of a class that doesn't have a traditional number one overall like guy as we enter the season, I think.
And that's what made me think, just from the limited amount I know about him, that Jaden Hardy could work his way into the mix. This is going to be a different G League Ignite season compared to the last one, but that scoring guard, it's not the archetype that you and I value the most, but a very good player at it can be very valuable. And we, you know, we're a few hours away from Jalen Green making his NBA debut, and yeah, you'd love that wing, whether that's AJ Griffin or Pat Baldwin or Watson, the UCLA guy, like you'd love for that guy to take a step forward. But Hardy, like if he can put the ball in the bucket at that volume and looks like he has enough athleticism, is he, I he's not a Green level of athlete, right?
No, I've been more saying like Bradley Beal level athlete, and okay. I think Beal often gets a little bit underrated as an athlete. But not like a nuclear, to quote you and Nate, like crazy athlete by any stretch.
I believe that's us taking it from Jay Billis, if memory serves, going back. I could be wrong on that. But yeah, this is a...
No, it's you. It's you.
Hey, I'll take credit for the things that I created, including the hilarious one. Oh, God. What? Oh, yeah. Why can't I just remember it? The Hinkie special. Like that was one that led to this funny thing when I don't know if I've told the story on the podcast that Zach Lowe used it. And I'm like, where did that come from? And I searched it. I'm like, oh, it came from me, which was delightful. And it was so, like, I mean, that was, I think like three or four entities ago. And as some people know, I don't change writing spots that often. So it was a while back, but it's going to be interesting to see how this class works itself out. They should have something closer to a normal season, which I think is really good for them. And that means there will be movement over the course of the year. And I'm excited to see that. But as we are on the precipice, I will leave some of the more NBA-specific conversations to a future conversation that the two of us are going to have on a different forum, probably, hopefully. But we spent so much time talking about the 2021 draft, and I wanted to get your thoughts on how this group has looked for you, Summer League, and in the preseason.
Really good. I mean, look, like, Summer League was great, and I thought that the guys who I expected to play well in Summer League played well. In the preseason, I think that, look, we haven't seen Cade yet, right? Because of the ankle injury. Jalen Green looks exactly like what I expected, a guy who's going to score some points and is going to cause some real defensive question marks for Houston early in the year. Scotty Barnes has looked a little bit better than what I thought he would early. I figured he would play from the jump because he is so good defensively that it's just worth having him on the court. But he looks a little bit more polished offensively. I know that pre-draft he did a lot of work over in Santa Barbara with like the folks over at P3 and his trainer for pre-draft, I believe, is Packy Turner. Like they've done a lot of work with Scotty on skill development and stuff, and I'm sure he has his own trainers as well. I don't mean to necessarily just call out those guys that I know of. Like I'm sure he works with more than just some other players, and I know that some trainers get a little bit touchy with that stuff from time to time. I think that Scotty Barnes has looked a little bit further ahead offensively than what I thought he would. I think that this is going to be a really strong rookie class this year. Like Davion Mitchell is going to come in and play immediately. Please tell me that you saw what Cam Thomas did last night, Danny.
I actually did. I was transitioning to deal with something, but I did not see it last night, unfortunately.
Danny, it was the most on brand, like funniest fucking thing in the world. Cam Thomas comes in, his first offensive possession, Javon Carter like drives, and I think that Cam was supposed to take like a pin down in space out beyond the 3-point line, but instead he curled and brought his man right to the area where Javon Carter was driving. And he just like kind of stopped in the mid-range, like 18-foot area for a bailout pass. Javon threw him the bailout pass, and he immediately fired from like 18 feet. His second possession, he got the ball in the corner, took like 10 dribbles, and eventually got like double-teamed and turned the ball over. So still has not yet completed a pass. His third possession was when the Bucks finally decided to take out like Giannis and all of their stars. So Thanasis fouled him, and he got to go to the foul line, and he shot two free throws. And then his fourth touch, and these were the only four touches he had all game, were his fourth touch was a catch and shoot three from the corner that he missed. So he had 4 minutes. He took two shots, two free throws, turned the ball over once, and completed zero passes. The question I asked John Hollinger earlier today was, will Ryan Fitzpatrick or Cam Thomas complete more passes this season?
Amazing. Let's go to a guy who's going to complete more passes. I still haven't seen as much Josh Giddey as I want because he missed Summer League and I missed most of the preseason. But the parts I saw were definitely intriguing. And NBA Chalamet has some work to do because he's going to be, you know, the jump shot and everything else. But if you can make good passes, there it's this weird nether region for me where I've gotten into trouble over the years of like tall guys who can pass. And I'm at least intrigued, but it's also like being a part of this Funhouse Mirror Bizarro Thunder team is going to make this even stranger.
Oh, NBA Chalamet. What an absolute king. What a fun player. Yeah, you're right. Like you definitely do love the big ball handler. The thing that I have questioned with Josh slightly, like I had Josh as a lottery grade. Like I really like him a lot as a player. Is just whether or not he can consistently get penetration at the NBA level. Like I think he has a bit of a high handle. I think he has just a bit of not quite as much like shake with the ball as what you'd like to see, but man, like hey, it doesn't matter because he can throw passes from any freaking angle on the court that you can imagine at any point. It's just like I'm very interested to see what the god NBA Chalamet looks like this year, because it could go really, he's guaranteed to be fun. I can tell you that. Like he is going to be a blast to watch.
Yeah, and this Thunder team is just so bizarre when you think about all the players who, like, I mean, you have Shea, who's already, when available, an incredible creator. But then you have all these other guys who kind of, it seems like they want the ball in their hands. In some cases, they're probably best that way because they're limited shooters, getting included in that group. So I have no idea how their ecosystem is going to work. I like Dagnall a lot as a coach. I thought his stuff looked very good in his first year.
Yeah.
And they're not trying to be good. So I think that you can make a lot of this stuff, the fit issues don't matter. Like, I think sometimes people focus on that. Now, it is good to have a viable system so that you can kind of get a sense of what these guys are and what they will be. But for Oklahoma City, I think it's conceptually, I mean, they have to actually be good, but you need to be willing to roll the dice to just see what comes up, because yeah, a lot of these guys, you could argue in an ideal world, are duplicative, but some of them aren't going to hit, and then those questions might just resolve themselves.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'm so interested in what Oklahoma City is doing, because like, I'm sure that you've talked about extensions on this podcast at some point, like in the recent past, but like, we saw Jonas Valanciunas get an extension today that you felt was an underpay, right?
I think it's reasonable is about where I would put it.
Yeah, like I think that he's like better than Clint Capela, and Clint Capela just got like $22 million on his extension number. I understand that, like, totally different players, right? But I think being able to get Valanciunas at $15 million a year, like, those are great numbers. And on top of it, they maintain the ability to trade him within the next 6 months, because the number, it was like, what? It was like an 8% raise, wasn't it, on the number that he's making this year?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of wonder if the DeAndre Ayton non-extension played a role in some of these, in like Jonas Valanciunas getting extended, because New Orleans may have felt like, hey, let's just lock in our guy now. You know, we're going to be competing against other teams for Ayton, you know, potentially if we want to try and sign DeAndre, or like the other teams that are going to be competing for Ayton, the other teams that are going to have cap space, like the Thunder, like Detroit. Look, like Charlotte isn't listed as a team that has max cap space now, but like, it's not going to be hard for them to create. Like we saw this summer, like max cap space is a figment of our imagination now, right? Like, you're telling me that if DeAndre Ayton goes to Phoenix and says, I really don't want to be here, that Phoenix wouldn't take Terry Rozier in like a sign and trade from Charlotte, right? Like, that's how easy it is for Charlotte to be able to create max cap space, and then they have a long-term center of the future for LaMelo Ball to build around.
Right? I will say, I think it would take more for the Suns to give up Ayton, and you talked about this. I mean, we both had kind of different areas.
No, I agree with you that it would take more than Terry Rozier, but I'm saying, like,
to match
in terms of the math.
Sure, yeah, sure.
Like, that's easy.
But the Ayton situation, there are a couple of wrinkles there that are absolutely fascinating. Let's save that for when we talk on game theory, because that's, I think, it's fertile ground for the two of us there. But in terms of the pending rookie class, I'm one of the, like, challenges of rookies for somebody who watches a team, you know, like, game in, game out, you know, so like for the people who have more, you know, are more singularly focused than the two of us are. It can be sometimes hard to see the forest, you know, to see the forest for the trees. The idea basically being that these players are mostly negative, that things aren't working out, but you're not looking for that. You're looking for these flashes, and maybe it's sustained play in certain periods of time. And that will be so interesting in this class for guys like Mobley and Jalen Suggs and potentially Jonathan Kuminga, where they could potentially play important roles on their teams, and at times their limitations could be more important. We'll see. I think Scottie Barnes is going to also have a much bigger part to play for the next little while until Pascal Siakam is available. Like, that is a latitude. It's sort of the reverse of what Kerr is getting with Wiseman this year. If it's like, well, let's try our rookie before the other guy gets back in, and then we can evaluate, versus let's try things without our second year guy, and then we'll figure out where he fits in after that.
Yeah. Like, you bring up the Warriors. The Warriors are a really fascinating example of that, because they obviously have Jonathan Kuminga. They drafted Jonathan Kuminga ahead of Moses Moody. Moses Moody is in the rotation earlier than Jonathan Kuminga, and I don't think anyone's really surprised by that. Like, that didn't surprise you, right?
No.
Because of just the way that their games are. Jonathan Kuminga is more of a shot creator, and it's harder to get a shot creator on the court whenever you already have like guys like Draymond Green and Stephen Curry, whereas Moses Moody is someone that is more of an off-ball player, catches and shoots, attacks closeouts, you know, bit of a more reliable rotation defender at this point. But the thing with the Warriors is that I'm sure that teams, like, does it help them to not play their rookies early? Does it help them to play their rookies early and try to showcase their value already? Because look, like, they've said for a while now that they're committed to younger, to going with like a youth movement right? Like they want James Wiseman, Moses Moody, Jonathan Kuminga to emerge and take some pressure off of, you know, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and Stephen Curry as those guys age. And they want to keep them. They've been very clear about that. But, I mean, look, if Bradley Beal comes available, like at some point, that's going to be a real conversation. And is it better for the Warriors to rely solely on what they think, like the Wizards' preconceived notions of guys like Moses Moody and Jonathan Kuminga were pre-draft before they've seen them play professional basketball? Or is it better for them to try and play them and take the risk that maybe they aren't as good early on? Like it's such a fascinating question to me as we start early on, especially with these teams that are kind of in like the middle of being, they're clearly good teams, but are they competitive for an NBA championship teams? Like the Warriors could very easily get competitive for an NBA championship in a hurry. And look, they might be already once Klay comes back. Like if Klay returns at 90% of who he is because he's fucking Wolverine, like it might be fine, right? But what do teams like the Warriors decide to do with their youngsters? What do the Kings decide to do with Davion Mitchell? Like Davion Mitchell has earned minutes, and I would imagine that he's definitely going to play. Does he play 15 minutes or does he play 30 minutes as a rookie, as maybe they try to showcase him as someone that could move like in a Ben Simmons deal if they really want to go out and try and get Ben Simmons, right? Scotty Barnes, same deal. Like Scotty Barnes, I don't know if they would move him in a Ben Simmons deal. Like they seem very excited by him, but like Toronto is in a fascinating position where they could pretty easily transition into being a rebuilding team, or they could transition into being a team that competes for a top four seed. Like I think there are so many teams in the middle this year that have these interesting rookies that I don't necessarily know what it's going to look like in terms of like who plays a lot of minutes, who doesn't.
Right. And it's a fascinating point. And I think generally speaking, if the team has aspirations like the Warriors do, then what your loyalty primarily lies in just build, you know, seeing if those guys can help. And if they can't, then I don't think you're going to move their calibrations of their value too dramatically. I think front offices are going to lean significantly more heavily on their scouting before the draft, especially for guys that were so recently selected. But there are also, like, as you brought up with Scotty Barnes, like these teams that need to decide what in the world they are. And I think for those teams, you need to play your young guys more because you need to figure out how they fit in. And so for the Raptors, I mean, I've brought up the point previously that they have so many guys, like an unusually large number, from Fred VanVleet, arguably Gary Trent, depending on how you feel about his contract, and probably not Siakam at this point because his contract is so rich, but like an OG, obviously, if you wanted to go that direction, who not only makes sense on good teams, but makes sense at their current salary on good teams. And so if Masai Ujiri, armed with his new power and his, you know, his long-term contract, wants to tear it down, he can. Now, that tear down can include trading Scotty Barnes or it cannot. My expectation would be that it would not. But it brings about a whole other set of possibilities, and that's part of why Mobley's situation is one that I'm keying on as well, because they gave Jared Allen a ton of money, and they also made the decision, you know, as involved in the Larry Nance trade, to bring Lauri Markkanen. Markkanen has 3 fully guaranteed years and then a partially guaranteed fourth season. And there are ways to make that three-headed monster work that and I think that over time, Kobe Altman, JB Bickerstaff, and the Cavs are going to need to figure out what Evan Mobley's ideal role is offensively and defensively. But they still have to figure that out. Like, I mean, I think the Cavs, unless they think they're going to be way better this year than I think they're going to be, there's not the downside, you know, the risk of like, oh, he's going to really drag us down. Like, you know, because most rookies are negative players. But for those, I think he's more in the camp, more like Jalen Green, maybe more like Cade, though I think Cade Cunningham is a different type of rookie than a lot of these guys, where in Mobley's case, you need the information because the information is valuable, and the downside, like contrasting with what you said about the Warriors, is the downside risk is functionally non-existent.
I'll say this, though, like, so A, I think you're much higher on the Cavs being able to figure out how to make Lowry, Jared Allen, Evan Mobley.
I'm saying it is conceptually possible. That is all I am saying.
On the court, it's conceptually possible to make that work.
And but for the clarity, I'm not saying that all of them play together. I'm saying more that you can get 48 minutes combined at two positions out of the three of them.
Yeah, totally. And I agree with that point. You can do that. I worry more about roster building when you're paying that much money to those guys. Although Lowry's deal will obviously end before you have to pay Evan Mobley a substantial amount of money. The problem there, though, is that for these first 2 years, you have Kevin Love's albatross deal, like weighing down their flexibility, right? It's hard. I guess that they're going to have one summer to like really, really try and like change the trajectory a little bit. But that's going to come in the summer where theoretically they should have paid Darius Garland already. Maybe they don't have a summer. I don't know. They're going to have to make some tough decisions though. And where I think the reason I bring all of this up, they kind of do need to figure out what Evan Mobley is. At least they need to figure out if enough flashes are there. And frankly, like I think that they are there. Like I think that Evan Mobley is going to be great. I think he's going to be an all-star level big. But they do need to figure out if he is flashing. Like it's not going to be consistent this year, I don't think. But is he flashing the all-star level skill often enough to where they feel like he can be a secondary creator for them offensively? And they need to see, okay, does he work better right now with Darius Garland or Colin Sexton? I think it's going to be Darius Garland. I know that like some Cavs fans got a little bit frustrated when I wrote that like I really like the sets when the Cavs use Darius Garland off the ball a little bit more, because they felt like Darius has too many moments where he just kind of stands around off the ball. I understand that, and I think it's a valid concern when he's not involved in the primary set. But when Darius like knows the ball is coming back to him and they're getting him the ball on the move, like they're running a dribble handoff where he's going to, you know, either take a dribble handoff or Evan Mobley slash last year it was Larry Nance and Kevin Love and Dean Wade often as well. If he knows that he's going to be involved in that primary action, he actually does like move pretty well, I think. And I love those sets where they utilize him as an off-ball player, because you get the threat of his shooting. Teams have to stay close on him, because if you don't stay close on him, he is going to knock down shots. Like he can shoot on the move. He played off the ball like for the first 3 years or 2.5 years of his high school career, and then developed point guard skills and took over Bradley Beal Elite really like partway through his 16 and under year, and then like all of his 17 and under year. So I kind of look at what the Cavs are building and trying to figure out what's going to work for them long term. I think that they would be smart to find out, does Evan Mobley have real chemistry with one of Darius Garland or Colin Sexton? Like, if you find that he has real chemistry with Colin Sexton and like that's really going to work, that could genuinely like change some of your team building strategies moving forward. And you have to make a decision on Colin Sexton within the next, what do we want to call it? Like 6 months, let's say. Like you probably need to know what you're going to do with him going into restricted free agency. You maybe don't have to move him at the trade deadline if you really want to keep him, but maybe that's it. Maybe you need to know by the trade deadline if he has some chemistry with Evan Mobley, right?
Yeah, and I think that there's also a possibility with Sexton of playing the string out, and I think that with his scoring, there's probably a team that would be interested in giving him the type of offer sheet that would make the Cavs sweat, especially if they think he's gettable. You know, like that can sometimes be an important differentiator there versus, let's say, I bring up the Marcus Smart restricted free agency a lot, where part of the reason he got burned was not only the idea that restricted free agency is about falling in love, but also because why would a team risk falling in love with somebody that they thought Danny Ainge was just going to match? But a data point that I think is worth tracking this year for Garland is that he attempted roughly the same proportion of, or same amount per game of catch and shoot threes and pull up threes. And as is common for most guys, he shot way better on the catch and shoot. He was 43% on catch and shoot threes and 36% on pull ups. Now, 36% on pull ups is impressive to me. I think that's, you know, that's another sign that he can get there. But the idea that you can shift that proportion, that you can kind of strike a different balance, not only through Colin Sexton, but also through somebody like Evan Mobley, is notable. And that could potentially open up some other directions for the Cavs. And it is also remarkable that they have used so much capital, both draft and in some cases trade slash, you know, financial, like the money that they gave to Jared Allen. And I would argue that they do not have a natural small forward on their roster. Like they, you know, Okoro, I think of as more of a two than a three. And maybe some people think Jetty Osman can play the three. But that is pretty incredible, unless like one of these other guys is different than I expect. And yes, maybe they can add that later. Maybe, you know, the Cavs are in the point in the draft where they can get one of those three, maybe whatever three they like best, like a Nurmagomedov, that could be Griffin, that could be Pat Baldwin, that could be Peyton Watson. But, you know, that's something that Cleveland is currently missing.
Yeah, and I think they're missing a few of them, to be honest. Like, I think that they need more than one true wing, like, with size that can defend multiple positions and can, like, slide down to the four and play a little bit smaller from time to time, right? Like, you don't just want one of those guys. You want multiple of those guys. And on top of it, those players tend to be the hardest thing to find in the NBA. And then there's also like the conversation, like I think, like, I don't know, like, do we think Kobe Altman's going to be the person making that choice? I don't know.
I'm more confident that I don't think he should be than that he will not be. I mean, that depends on ownership and everything else.
Yeah, I think that ownership is going to be intrigued to see how they look this year. Like, if they, I think their over under was like 28.5. Like, if they're around that level, they're like, he, you would almost think he's probably going to get fired, right? Like, I can't imagine that he wouldn't, right?
It seems like it's going that direction, and I don't know what they would be looking for in the next general manager, but I mean, Altman's had a lot of chances, and certain parts of it, like, I criticize him a lot for the Larry Nance extension. That worked out very well. I mean, Nance ended up being a good part of it. I think they actually, personally, I think they got too little for him, but, you know, he helped them. He became a very positive value on that contract.
Yeah, and they nailed that deal. It was just that they then transitioned it into this Markkanen deal instead of like multiple first round picks.
Sure. I would agree with that. And so I don't know, you know, I had an extended conversation with our mutual friend Jared Dubin about this idea of expectations and whether there is a point where it doesn't really matter whether, from the people whose thoughts on this matter, which is typically ownership and maybe a couple other people involved, it doesn't really matter whether their expectations are reasonable or not, because their expectations are what affect the decisions that they make. And so for various teams in this process, Cleveland is one of those. Sacramento is one of those with how Vivek feels about this team. I think we're a little early for Chicago to do anything crazy if this doesn't work out too well. But Washington and a couple others, like, there are some real question marks in terms and potential trouble spots. The lower half of the Western Conference is just chock full of these, with New Orleans probably being the head of the table in terms of what could be a margin between what the people who matter expect the season to look like and what it very well might look like.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely a really good point. The Kings are like kind of the prime example, because they're dealing with this Marvin Bagley situation now, which is Jeff Schwartz does not speak often, but when he does, his voice carries weight. The Kings, like, it'd be great if they had another year to, like, see if Marvin Bagley can be anything. They've given, like, and look, they've given Marvin Bagley chances, right? Like, I know that people close to Marvin feel like that's not the case, but they have. Like, he started 42 games last year. Like, he played 26, 27 minutes a night last year. Like, he got the opportunity and just isn't good enough yet. And that makes more sense for him, with a coach that makes more sense for him as well. Luke Walton, I think you and I would both agree, not the pinnacle of NBA coaching, right?
I would agree with that. Well, and so part of it for Bagley, I mean,
but like,
I agree with you that Bagley's had the chances. But I also another kind of component of this for him is I know that that Schwartz and XL would love to see him in a situation that's right for Bagley right now. There is also an argument that being somewhere that doesn't really want you, heading into restricted free agency as a high draft pick, is actually a good thing because they are more willing to just say, fine, and just let you go. This is, you know, the Frank Ntilikina part of this, that if the team is more invested and thus more frustrated, then I think there's a very significant chance that if Marvin Bagley ends this season as a restricted free agent, if he ends the season on the Kings, that he becomes an unrestricted free agent. And that gives him, the world is his oyster. Like, that would actually be, I would be as Schwartz, like, that's what I would be hoping for more, though I understand that he, you know, advocating for his client is looking more to get him in a better situation before July 2nd.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that's the thing, though. Like, it worked out so well for Frank Ntilikina that he signed a 2-year, $3.8 million deal.
That's fair.
Right? Like, I think that, and look, Marvin's made money already. Like, that's the thing about being the number two overall pick. Like, I think that by the end of this year, he's going to end up being, like, 40, right around, like, the $40 million mark.
Yeah,
right?
At least 35. I mean, he's making 11.3 this year.
Yeah, so that's, like, not an insubstantial amount of money. Like, Frank was probably around, like, you know, 15, 16, I would guess, is the number 8 overall pick. It really spikes when you're the number 2 overall pick. So I think that maybe you are right. Like, he's made enough money. He really just needs to find a spot where he can go, like, short term, like maybe almost like Nerlens Noel, right? Like, try and parlay a minimum deal into a longer term deal somewhere. But it's really hard to come back from that, I think. And I understand why Jeff Schwartz would want to get Marvin into a better system before restricted free agency in order to try and, like, expedite that process, because you're essentially starting brand new once you're in that, like, minimum vortex, right?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I'll leave you with this question about the 21 class. When I do the Division Capsule podcast, typically the last question I ask is picking breakout candidates, and the way I define it is players that we will talk about meaningfully differently a year from now than we are right now. So let's exclude, like, the top five picks or so, you know, those type of guys.
Sure.
But who do you see in this class, partially based on role, partially based on just what they are as a player, that this year, because, I mean, remember, most rookies are negative players. Like, that's just the way this works out. And you can have that and still be we can talk about you differently because you show some flashes or everything else. Like, there are lots of different ways that can work out. But who are you keying on as being potential guys that can really change the conversation?
Yeah, look, I think I had Trey Murphy higher than anyone else in the public sphere, at least. Like, I had him, I think, at, like, 15 pre-draft. He went 17. Most people had him at, like, 20 or so. He looks awesome.
Trey Murphy.
Yeah, he's looked awesome since Summer League. He's looked good in the preseason. I think we're going to look at him and be like, why in the hell did this guy not go in the top 10? He is a 6'9", legit floor spacing shooter who is conscientious defensively, has real length, has the ability to switch. Like, yeah, I think that the conversation around him, like, I think he should be starting for the Pelicans, like, tonight. And Willie Green is doing that thing where, like, he hasn't revealed his starting lineup. We're probably 30 minutes away from that happening. I think he should be in their opening night starting lineup, and I think that he should be a double-digit scorer as a rookie who plays, like, solid defense and makes 40% of his threes. Like, and if he does that, it's going to be – I think he's, like, a higher upside version of what Sadiq Bey was for Detroit last year. And Sadiq Bey kind of changed the conversation about himself.
I would say he definitely qualifies last year.
Yeah, so I think that Trey Murphy would be one pick. Yeah, I liked what I've seen of Isaiah Jackson. I just don't know how often he'll play.
I agree. Like, when I saw Jackson in Summer League, I'm like, oh, this guy is talented. Like, I thought he looked good. you know that I've been a Josh Christopher stan for a long time, and the difference with him is he might actually get the opportunity because Houston has no qualms about playing nobody. All of their young guys.
And they have nobody else on that roster, especially once Eric Gordon gets sent to Siberia or another NBA team, hopefully for his case.
And then the other group that I'm going to keep an eye on, I mean, a hallmark of our conversations over the last 3-4 years has been the value of wings. Which of these kind of forward-sized players of Kuminga and Franz Wagner and Barnes and Jalen Johnson and Trey and, you know, which of these guys?
Yeah, I'll give you one. Now that I think about it, like, I think Jeremiah Robinson Earl, he's probably closer to like a 4-5 than like the true wing that you're talking about, but he'll be more of a 4. I think people are going to wonder how he went in the second round.
He's going to play. I mean, we know that. And for people to remember, he was also a part of one of the single strangest trades that we've seen in modern vintage, where OKC gave up, I think it was they gave up 34. They gave up 34 and 36 to move up to 32.
Correct.
So you can tell they like him because that's a lot of draft capital to give up for somebody who's just, you know, basically you're betting that the Clippers, you're saying the Clippers were going to take him.
Yeah, I think that was a deal that happened after Santi Aldama went 30 to Memphis. I think that they may have wanted to like earmark one of those picks for him and then maybe take a Robinson Earl. But maybe I'm wrong on that. Like maybe I'm misreading kind of the tea leaves on some of the things that I've been told. Yeah, I think that Jeremiah Robinson Earl is going to be really, really good this year. And I think he's going to be really valuable for their rotation. I can't imagine that he's not going to play. I had him ahead of Trey Mann on my board. They took Trey Mann 14 slots ahead of him. I thought he was much better than Trey Mann. I'm not really a Trey Mann guy, though. It's funny. Like a lot of the guys that I like, I just worry that they're not going to get opportunity. Like, I've heard really good things about Herb Jones, like in camp, but how is Herb Jones going to play with the Pelicans is kind of my worry. I really love Deuce McBride. I thought he had a great summer league. He's like their fourth point guard, right? So how is he going to play? It's just like kind of hard to find. Like there are some guys that I think could really, Jared Butler might be the prime example of this, right? Jared Butler has looked amazing in the preseason. I had a top 20 grade on him. I know he fell due to the injury concerns. Like he looks incredible right now, but how is he going to play? Because they have all of Donovan Mitchell, Mike Conley, Jordan Clarkson, Joe Ingles ahead of him. Like not all of those guys are going to play every game, and he's going to be able to step in games where they don't play. But man, like he should be playing for an NBA team in a rotation right now. And it's just hard because he's on like the exact wrong team to be playing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the general concept, though, is that these things will work out over time, that if he's good enough, the Jazz will create the opportunity. And while Butler is older than some of those guys, because he's already 21, this will be his age 21 season, there's still lots of time for him there. So I'm keeping an eye on that one as well. And it's going to be such a notable year in terms of movement and what, and you know, we kind of see where things are, what's setting the table for future years. And this is, you know, the closest thing we've had, hopefully, knock on wood, to a normal season. So we get the opportunity not only to evaluate these rookies, but the guys over the last couple of years as well.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe we'll talk about the other guys at some other point, just because we're running long and I know you have an out here coming up.
Yes.
But yeah, this is a fun NBA season. Like I'm thrilled for this NBA season to be starting. Like there are so many fun storylines, there's so many fun teams. It feels really open in my mind in terms of who could win the title. Like there are just like there are so many reasons to be excited about this NBA season. I am really pumped to watch it.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited too. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course, Danny, anytime.
Thanks again to Sam Vecenie for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and you can also listen to the Game Theory podcast that he does, which alluded to on this. I'm going to be a guest on in the very near future. Don't know the exact timing there, but we're going to talk about some of the NBA topics. Thought it'd be fun to do kind of a home and home. So you can expect to hear me on Game Theory at some point in the very near future, potentially by the time you've listened to this, depending on when you do that. You can also, of course, if you don't already, follow Sam on Twitter at Sam_Vecenie, SAM_VECENIE. Love having him on. And I, you know, if you're interested in the kind of day-to-day NBA stuff, that's mostly going to be on Dunked On, which you can listen to with me with Nate. And I think of Real GM Radio as kind of a complement to the other things that I do. More big picture. That doesn't mean it will be, you know, just all esoteric or anything like that. Definitely not. But especially over these first few weeks, I like to take a little bit of time to get stock and everything else. And so we'll keep an eye on that. That'll be the kind of the ebb and flow. But if you want to support this podcast, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode that's great in whatever podcast player you use, because the show's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. It's my availability, guest availability. Can do it that way. Also, you can help other people find the show. That's leaving a rating and a review in the podcast player if you're choosing, Spotify, Apple, wherever, and just telling people, hey, this episode, this podcast in general is something you might enjoy, and that can really make a big difference. And you can also check out my other work, the aforementioned Dunked On Prime. So we do one free episode a week, and then we're back to the normal everything else, you know, 4+ episodes a week being subscription and including our big breakdown of what I call League Pass opening night. And then it's now official, the NBA cast is back, and Nate and I are going to be doing basically every Monday this year. And we did yesterday on Wednesday, we did the Wolves demolition of the Houston Rockets, but we'll be doing Celtics Hornets is our first Monday game. You can keep an eye on that. The timing will, of course, change depending on matchup, but it'll be Mondays moving forward. Nate and I absolutely love doing that. And then I have a bunch of pieces in the offing with The Athletic. So you can keep an eye on that. I'm kind of one of the things I want to do over the next few weeks is really set the table for the 2022 offseason. And there's some, you know, now that the extensions are done, we have a lot of clarity on where things are going to start. We don't necessarily have clarity on where they're going to end, but we have that. And if you have any feedback on Real GM Radio, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I would like to get better at responding, but I admit that's not my forte, but I do read everything and I often reread everything, and I actually just reread a bunch of them, which I really do appreciate. And if it's constructive, I appreciate that too. And there was a bunch of that as well. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.
A healthy lifestyle depends on quality sleep, and Sleep Number is here to help you sleep more efficiently. Sleep efficiency is the amount of restful sleep you have at night and is a key part of your overall health. Here are some tips to help you get the most efficient sleep possible. Reduce caffeine consumption before noon and limit late night alcohol. Get regular exercise during the day, which helps you feel tired in the evening. And keep track of your sleep health with data from your Sleep Number 360 smart bed. Sleepers who routinely use their Sleep Number 360 smart bed features get almost 100 hours more proven quality sleep per year. With that much extra energy, you could get more quality family time, volunteer at a meaningful charity, or exercise, meditate, and reconnect with nature. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep, which starts with Sleep Number adjustability. It's time for Sleep Number's ultimate Sleep Number event. Save 50% on the Sleep Number 360 limited edition smart bed, plus special financing for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com/podcast1. Subject to credit approval, minimum monthly payments required. See sleepnumber.com/podcast1 for details.
Microsoft Surface Pro 8 has the power of a laptop and the versatility of a tablet, all in one. This thin and adaptable device has a touchscreen and a newly designed signature keyboard that can even store your Surface Pen. Surface Pro 8 is Microsoft's most powerful Pro yet. Show the world how you stand out with Surface Pro 8. Check it out at surface.com/surfacepro8.